Your name, please?
Gore Vidal.
And your occupation and position?
I am an author, and consequently have no position.
Mr. Vidal, you've written a number of books regarding leadership. Do you think that people get the leadership they deserve?
My viewpoint is that, all in all, yes, they probably do.
This is Viewpoint, an unrehearsed and personal interview with Gore Vidal, who will reveal to you what he holds to be the responsibilities of his position in life. Produced by the Episcopal Church and brought to you as a public service by this station. Mr. Kennedy's guest today is Gore Vidal, one of America's outstanding novelists, whose works include The City and the Pillar, The Best Man, and Julian. Here is the moderator of the award-winning series, Viewpoint, the Reverend Dana F. Kennedy. Mr. Kennedy.
Welcome to Viewpoint, Mr. Gore Vidal. When you say that people get the leadership they deserve, what are the qualities which you think they deserve?
Well, you would have to define the society at that given moment. What is the society? And then you would study it, and then you would look to see what sort of leadership it had. Take the French Third Republic. You had a society which was not much interested in anything other than personal comfort and survival, and therefore you had a government which turned out to be rather laissez-faire and somewhat corrupt, and under the first pressures of Nazism, it collapsed.
What are some of the characteristics of today's society in the United States which, in your estimation, determine what they want in leadership?
Well, I should say that the one thing which seems to me through the country is an absolute fear of anything like a real debate or a real fact. We deal entirely in images in our politics and in our private lives, pretty much. And anything which looks like an actual sharp fact or a debate, you know, T.S. Eliot once said that the first sign of intelligence is the ability to recognize a fact. And non-recognition of fact, I would say, was the principal quality of our society at this moment, and we see it reflected in politicians interested in their images.
In this desire for images, is this ignorance on the part of people, or is this a deliberate attempt on their part to stay away from fact?
Well, it's a mixture. I would say that the people taken by and large were generalizing hugely, but they tend to be rather apathetic and not much interested in politics unless there's some enormous crisis like a war or a depression.
Is this desire for images only confined to politics, or does this run through all of life?
One sees it everywhere. One sees it obviously in advertising, which is the most blatant use of image as opposed to fact. We can watch some of our cigarette ads at the moment to see how desperately they're trying to readjust an image to some rather disagreeable facts as presented by the Surgeon General's office about smoking. It is probably, perhaps it's the definition of our kind of a democracy, is that by and large we're terrified of our neighbors. We're terrified of being thought different. We're terrified of opening up any kind of moral problem which might make people uncomfortable. This is why the whole Negro situation has erupted with such peculiar force, because we tried to pretend for so long that it was not there or it was getting better.
Is it possible, in your estimation, for a country or a person to live in hypocrisy and get away with it?
Oh, of course. Most people are born in it, live in it, and die in it, and the final madness of hypocrisy is at last they don't even know that they're in it. I don't say that people are being willfully wicked about it. It's just the way they are. For instance, in America, we take it for granted. You'd ask any American citizen, do you believe in thrift? And he'd say, of course I do. I mean, my father and my grandfather, they believed in thrift, and you put your money by and you save for a rainy day. But if any American practiced it, our economy would collapse, because our economy is based upon 90% spending of the dollar of total consumption. We are consumers now. Thrift has not been operative in America for 50 years. If anybody practiced it, Detroit would go out of business and we would have the greatest disaster economically we've ever had. Now, this is a case of unconscious hypocrisy. He'll say he believes in thrift, and however, he's in hock. That is the difference between an image and a reality.
Does the reality never catch up with people then?
Well, if you don't keep up your payments on the car, it's very likely to take a disagreeable turn, yes, but he would say that was bad luck. He was still practicing thrift, but somehow the bills got ahead of him.
Do you think that when a whole society lives by images that...
I think it's in terrible trouble, yes. That's one of the reasons I bothered to write, is to keep pricking away and reminding people and stirring them up and saying, well, you say that you believe this, you think that you believe this, but actually you don't. This is what your situation is. And I think one cannot do that enough. It's discouraging, of course, but one does not get greatly loved for this, but at the same time, it's being useful.
Do you personally find that the truth and facts are exciting to deal with?
Oh, truth is always exciting, and fact is always exciting. I mean, there's truth in an absolute sense, of course, is without revelation is difficult to arrive at. However, facts we can usually cope with, you know, whether it be unemployment or damage done by cigarette smoking. I mean, we can determine certain things, and the closer we stay with them, the healthier we are.
There's been, from time to time, comparisons of our present situation with that of the Roman Empire when it was about to collapse. Do you think there's any comparison that is truthful?
No, I don't believe in historical analogies, and the people who use them generally don't understand either their own society or the historic one they're describing. All societies share certain things. Andre Malraux said quite recently, he said, you know, that if Ramesses the Pharaoh and Napoleon were to meet, they would have much more in common than Napoleon, say, and Darwin, because they would talk about agriculture, the police, the difficulties of running a society, which is pretty much the same at any time. And I don't think that these people, you know, they were those who really thought that the Roman Empire in the 19th century thought it collapsed because people took too many baths. In actual fact, the Roman Empire collapsed because of the difficulty of their laws of succession, which I've gone into in my novel, Julian, which is about the period.
In your estimation, can a morality or a system of ethics exist for long if it has no basis?
In religion, indeed it can. It existed for thousands of years before Christianity, and it still exists among those who are not Christians and yet highly moral and highly ethical. Every page of Plato is suffused with the idea of morality and of ethics and of man's behavior to man and man's relationship to his society, whether it be in Plato's Republic or in the Timaeus, you get it all through him.
What is the driving force that makes a person of this kind believe in his ethics and live by them?
Well, a sense of, first of all, the need and value of the society to which he belongs, an identification with that society up to a point, and that its good and his own good should coincide. It is agreed upon. I don't think anybody much argues that you probably should not willfully hurt other people or take their money away from them or kill them. These are certain basic ethical things which we all more or less accept, but you can get into a kind of mood, which, for want of a better word, we can use existential, in which any action has no value, or every action has equal value. And that means that you then have thrown out any hierarchy of judgment, any scale. So between my saying an unkind word as a critic about a book and my cutting the head off the man who wrote the book, they would say, well, there is no choice between the two, you know, that it's the same ethical system. Well, I think that shows a decline, if not a collapse, of any moral system.
Do you find in today's world that reason and persuasion and satire are allowed to survive in all areas of life as they should be?
Well, reason, there is never very much of at any given point. Most of us are profoundly unreasonable. We are victims of our own flesh and blood, prejudice, mood, environment. I would say that reason certainly exists in American life. It's just getting up the connections, that's all, the connections between it and between the people. As for satire, it's a very useful weapon. I think it's been slightly overused lately, at least I'm getting very tired of the word. But obviously, it is a sign of critical maturity in a society that it can criticize itself. I've just lived through this with The Best Man, a film about politics, which was just shown in at the Cannes Film Festival. And the Americans would not enter it as the American entry, and it wasn't going to be there at all, except the French Society of Authors saw it, and they insisted it be shown. So I went to Cannes, and, the press very much liked it, and it did much better than the American entry, but the main feeling about it was, so this is critical of the United States and shows American politics in perhaps a dark way, but they said, but we couldn't even make a film like this in France. The result is that the whole reaction in Europe was what a thing that they have in America, that, you know, they can make these statements about their society. And they said not one country in Western Europe could have done this, with the exception of England, but on the continent of Europe.
How important in the thinking of these people whom you admire was the worth of an individual?
I would think that anybody who made a strong satiric statement must believe that the individual is not only enormously important, but must be instructed, saved, criticized. I don't believe that anybody with a really negative view would ever take the trouble to satirize. Satire is the desire to correct abuses, to correct folly. And that can only come out of somebody who cares deeply.
What do you feel are aspects of a really fine human being?
I would say a sense of justice and an ability to identify with other people, which is very difficult, because I don't think we really like one another very much. And the more tensions, the more closely we're thrown with people, the more they tend to irritate and exasperate us, just as we irritate and exasperate them. But at some point, one must always be able to shift that gear and sort of say, well, I can see why he's behaving as dreadfully as he is because of X, Y, and Z. And this is, to me, the first sign of maturity, when you are able to suddenly shift out of your own total self-interest and begin to perceive dimly that you're up against just as much self-interest, which it might be helpful for you to understand. And then once you understand that, then I believe the sense of justice is the desire to make things right and to have a hierarchy of values, which doesn't have to be terribly subtle or terribly esoteric, yet you would then apply them once you've understood the situation.
Do you think, Mr. Vidal, that the churches of today are being helpful at all in this growth of the personality towards maturity?
Well, there has been a sort of meeting head-on in the last few years with social issues like integration, and I find that extremely admirable. And I'm perfectly willing to give two cheers for the churches, not three, but two, as possible wielders of moral authority and giving moral definition.
What are the satisfactions, Mr. Vidal, which you get from your work?
Well, the feeling that one has illuminated something for others, that you have suddenly got through, that you have said something that needs saying, whether it be about the way we make presidents or what the early days of Christianity were like, how Christian doctrine was put together. I think it's just simply that one, well, you've got through.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gore Vidal, for being with us and for giving us your viewpoint.
Thank you.
This has been Viewpoint, an unrehearsed and personal interview with Gore Vidal, produced as a public service by the Division of Radio and Television of the Episcopal Church. Today's guest was Gore Vidal, one of America's outstanding novelists, whose works include The City and the Pillar, The Best Man, and Julian.